Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part three of our series on the physical property of stickiness. Maybe you didn't know we were going to do a part three. Maybe we didn't know we were going to do a part three, but here we are back to finish it out today. Now, in part one of this series, we talked about starches and sticky foods, most notably sticky rice, a.k.a. sweet rice, a.k.a. glutinous rice, a wonderful foodstuff that has a lot of interesting chemical properties. And this sort of came up in the context of my inspiration for this series, which was, my young child is eating fruits and fruit-based foods, and those tend to, like, leave mysterious sticky patches all over the house now. But we did that in part one. In part two, we talked about the unbelievably sticky feet of geckos, and we also talked about a chapter in a book I've been reading called Sticky, The Secret Science of Surfaces by Laurie Winkless, which is out just this year. And this chapter talked about different ways that adhesive materials actually stick to one another. Seems like it is much more complicated and less well understood than you might guess.
That's right. One of the realities we keep coming up against in this series is that, yeah, the word sticky covers a lot of ground. And so, if you can't just narrow it down and say, oh, well, this is sticky and this is something else. Like, what kind of sticky? What flavor of sticky are you talking about? It's a very general term.
And as we come back to explore the topic for one more episode, I'm going to take us in a much less physical and more metaphorical direction, because I got very interested in the idea of sticky mental content. What makes a memory or an idea stick in the mind? And of course, this is a question that could be looked at a ton of different ways. I just isolated one facet of this issue because it was so interesting to me. What I want to talk about is something known as flashbulb memories. Rob, I wonder if you have similar experiences to this. I remember when I was young, hearing my parents and friends of theirs, people my parents' age, you know, they'd be talking at a party or get together or something. And I remember them saying almost this exact sentence: I remember exactly where I was when I heard about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember hearing this sort of thing growing up. And then, of course, post 9/11, there were all new versions of this. Everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people had a similar take. I remember exactly where I was, what I was wearing, what breakfast cereal I was eating when this occurred. Right.
Exactly right. So in these types of memories, you find out about some public event that has happened, and you seem to have a memory of that moment of finding out that is just rich with incredible vivid detail, and you have extreme confidence about the accuracy of those details. I remember my parents saying this about the Kennedy assassination, or people my parents were talking to. People our age, like you say, might have similar memories about the 9/11 attacks. And if you're one of these people and you have a memory of this kind, you can almost like go back to that moment bodily right now. You remember exactly where you were, who you were with, how you heard about it, and so forth. I actually do have a very clear and strong memory of finding out about the 9/11 attacks in high school. I remember we were gathering for some kind of morning school assembly, and I saw a friend of mine, and I sat down next to him, and he mentioned that he had heard something. I think he said on the radio or something, but he mentioned he had heard something about a plane hitting the World Trade Center. And I have no way of knowing now if this memory is actually accurate, but it feels extremely accurate. It has stuck in my mind like glue.
Yeah, I mean, I have similar memories, but I also feel like we've covered we've covered false memories enough on the show before, and we've discussed this exact scenario regarding these memories that we think we can trust, but ultimately, upon close scrutiny, the details fall apart. Like, that's enough to where I probably distrust these memories more compared to other memories, just because I know the sort of thing that goes on with them.
Right.
So I'm hesitant to really even state that I was wearing this or I was with so and so. And I even more recent examples of this sort of thing. Like, I remember where I was when I heard about the last presidential election results, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But when I pause to think about it for more than a moment and ask myself, well, can you really name all the people that were there? Do you remember exactly where you were when you were finishing up this kayak excursion, and then you somebody checked their phone and found the news? No, I'm not that confident in the memory.
Well, yeah, I guess the irony is that given how much we read about memory research and how much we've been primed by all of these studies finding, you know, the illusory confidence people have in things. Maybe the fact that it feels so sticky in my brain makes me actually more suspicious of it. But people in general, I think, are mostly not suspicious of memories like this. People in general think, well, yeah, maybe memory is inaccurate sometimes. But one I'm absolutely certain about is I remember hearing about the Kennedy assassination, or, you know, decades and decades later. Or I remember where I was when I heard about 9/11. That is like the highest quality memory in my brain. And yet, given neither of these historical examples, you know, 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination, do we usually have vivid, elaborate memories about other events the same week? You know, if you ask somebody who strongly remembers exactly how they heard about the Kennedy assassination, they don't have detailed memories of what they had for lunch the day before or what they did after school the day after. So what causes the details of a specific memory to become sticky in this way, where it stays in your mind for, you know, 60 years later and still feels like it's in such incredibly vivid detail, like you know that you're remembering it exactly right? And why do these memories seem so accurate compared to our forgetfulness of other memories from around the same time in our lives? And why do these kinds of intense, detailed snapshot memories tend to be associated? Of course, we have similarly intense memories about other types of things, but why is a category for these intense, vivid memories learning about a big, momentous public event, often a public tragedy? Another often cited example is the Challenger explosion. And it turns out psychologists have actually studied this phenomenon and have looked into these questions. They have firmer answers to some of these questions than other ones. These types of memories have a special name. They're called flashbulb memories. So I think the idea behind the name is it's kind of like, there is a flash photograph taken in a darkened room. So everything around it is dark and obscure, but the flash goes off and a picture of a particular moment is captured and then frozen in memory, perhaps for the rest of your life.
In fact, I think if we could ask JJ to do this, JJ, can you hit us with just the sound effect of a flash bulb? Because many of you haven't heard it in real life at this point, or haven't in a long time, but you've probably heard it in movies, often with kind of a freeze frame black and white effect, which does kind of get to the heart of it. Like the idea that here is something that has occurred and it is just, you know, flashbulb sound effect. It is set in your mind, and it will never change. This is a pristine memory of what is occurring.
Okay, so time to mention a source. I've been reading a paper collecting and summarizing the research on flashbulb memories. This paper is called Flashbulb Memories, published in Current Directions in Psychological Science in the year 2016. And this is by William Hurst and Elizabeth A. Phelps. So this is trying to look at all of the research that had been done up till that point and see what conclusions could be drawn. So the term flashbulb memories traces back to a pair of researchers named Roger Brown and James Kulik, who studied the phenomenon and published important research on it in the year 1977. So to briefly separate out, just so there's no confusion, what flashbulb memories are and what they are not. Flashbulb memories are memories of the circumstances in which one learned about a public event. So it's when you found out about a public event. And this differentiates it from firsthand memories, like the kind of memory where you remember an event that happened to you personally, something you were there for, rather than something that you heard about or read about. So flashbulb memories are kind of interesting in that they straddle two different kinds of memory at the same time. In one sense, they are autobiographical because they're directly asking you to remember things about where you were and who you were with and what happened to you and what you felt. But they concern that that situation that you're remembering in your own life is elicited by a public event. It's not something that happened directly to you, but a moment of gaining information, of learning about something that happened to other people. Another distinction is because they're autobiographical, flashbulb memories are different from what are called event memories in the literature. That name can be a little confusing because it's like if you have a memory of an event in your life, that sounds like that would be an event memory. But what this refers to is information about the public event itself. So you might have your flashbulb memory of finding out about the Kennedy assassination. That's where you were, how you heard about it, all that stuff. But then also there would be public event memories, which would be things like the date that it happened, what time of day, the city it took place in, what type of car Kennedy was riding in, the name of the alleged assassin, and so forth. This is like information about the eliciting event. That's also a different kind of memory. So the flashbulb memory is an autobiographical memory about yourself in the circumstance of learning about this important public event. And examples of events that have been studied for creating flashbulb memories include assassinations and other politically charged public events. Also things with a more positive connotation, the paper cited like relevant World Cup victories, like if your country wins the World Cup. Also events like the fall of the Berlin Wall and also natural disasters like major earthquakes.
Okay. But at least some positive things thrown in the mix. Okay.
A lot more negative things than positive things have been studied. And I want to talk about that later because that may be interesting. I wonder if there are differences in how those things are recorded. I guess the news that's worth reporting is more often bad than good.
Right, right.
So Brown and Kulik, the two researchers who did this important early work on flashbulb memories, argued that even though these public events don't happen to us personally, they involve so much emotion that the brain records them kind of as if they did happen to us personally in the moment that we find out about them. So we have these unusual levels of accurate and exquisite detail. So ultimately, they sort of said these memories seem to be reliable and unchanging, like a photograph. In fact, the words they use, which are quoted in this review paper, they say these memories were, quote, unchanging as the slumbering Rheingold.
Oh, well, that's nice. It is interesting, the idea that even though it doesn't happen to you directly, like through our media absorption, we do a lot of living vicariously through people in the media, celebrities, and the public eye, and so forth. And then I also wonder, too, you think about how we've evolved as a species and the sort of groups we are supposed to occupy and the sort of information about said groups we would have. Like, we didn't evolve to live in a, you know, continental or global society in which you could have something catastrophic occur that did not directly or potentially directly affect you.
Right. I mean, yeah. So I almost think there is maybe a mental switch that has to be flipped where we can like ignore most of the news we encounter as being like, well, that doesn't directly affect me. But for some reason, there's an emotional switch that you can flip where even if it doesn't directly affect your life, it's hit that emotion and now it feels like it does. It feels like it happened, you know, something that happened to the president of the United States feels like it happened to the leader of your 10 person band.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there are a lot of moving parts here because you can also, you know, draw in things like social norms and our, you know, intense need to fit in socially with our given survival group and so forth.
Right. Maybe we can come back and speculate more on this when we finish with what the research has found. So what we have, Brown and Kulik, they say these memories, they are as unchanging as the slumbering Rheingold. You just remember what happened in that moment and it never changes the rest of your life. It is like the treasure under the water being guarded by the Rhine maidens.
Yes, the three Rhine maidens.
But the authors of this review paper point out that Brown and Kulik didn't actually have information that would justify the claim that flashbulb memories were unchanging as the Rheingold, because they had nothing to compare their subjects' accounts to. Essentially, people would be prompted to recall a flashbulb memory, like, do you have a memory of this? And then people would say, just like we've heard before, yes, I remember exactly where I was. This is how I found out. Here's what happened. Here are all the details. Now, in light of other findings in psychology that people can have the strong, genuine impression of remembering things in ways that you can prove objectively are inaccurate, some researchers started to doubt whether these flashbulb memories were actually as accurate as Brown and Kulik suggested, and as accurate as people generally feel that they are in their own lives. But this would be a difficult thing to test, right? Like, what can you do? You can't follow people around 24/7 with a video camera and just wait for them to hear about a major public event and then test them on it later and compare it to the videotape. That's obviously not feasible. Mm-hmm. So while testing the true accuracy of flashbulb memories to the direct events themselves, the moment people find out about these things, that would be extremely difficult. But researchers did come up with what I think is a very clever proxy, and it's very simple. Instead of testing accuracy, they would test consistency. And so this would work on the test-retest method. So it works like this. As soon as possible after a major public event, the same day if possible, or the very next day, you give people a questionnaire asking them to narrate how they found out and answer a whole bunch of autobiographical questions about that moment. You know, where were you? How did you hear about it? Who was with you? And so forth. And then you just hold on to their answers to that questionnaire. And then after a delay, you give subsets of that initial sample group at different periods exactly the same questionnaire. So maybe a few days later, some people get it, maybe a few weeks later, a few months, even years down the road. And you simply compare their answers to the later questionnaire to what they said immediately after the event. So what do studies of this sort reveal? Well, the results are a little bit mixed. There are a few reports supporting some broad levels of consistency after delays. But the majority of these studies have found substantial changes to flashbulb memories over time. And for the most part, we have no idea that these changes are happening in our own brains. We remember the flashbulb moment one way a year later, and it feels intensely vivid and accurate. And we are sure this is exactly how it happened. We could not be wrong, but it's not what we said happened the same day or the day after. Now, I guess you could say it's possible that the first questionnaire is wrong, that the initial reports from right around the time of the event are not accurate. But if there are differences between what you remember the same day or the day after and what you remember a year later, is it likely that the memory from a year later is the more accurate one? I would tend to think no. And so while consistency is different from accuracy, I think it's a decent proxy for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, this also brings me back to other memory-related topics we've discussed in terms of retrieval errors and the idea that every time you retrieve a memory, it is susceptible to change. Yes. So frequently retrieved memories, or the memories we retrieve the most, are also the ones that have been augmented the most. And I can imagine you have a scenario, too. It's like, what is causing you to retrieve said memory? And the necessity of the retrieval then alters the surface of the memory retrieved, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that may well play a role in what's going on here, because there are patterns of how we treat different types of autobiographical memories. And these flashbulb moments are things that may well be sort of unusually rehearsed compared to other day-to-day memories.
Yeah, yeah. And they could, for instance, they can be potentially altered by someone else retrieving said memory. Someone else telling you where they were when such and such happened. And then you retrieve your story. But maybe it's a little bit different this time. Maybe it's a little more like the one you just heard. Or it's sort of almost intentionally different in some regards compared to the one you just heard. There's so many ways you could slice it.
Despite the fact that I think Brown and Kulik were wrong about these memories being accurate and unchanging, or at least being wrong about them being unchanging, they did discover something important, which was that these memories are sticky in one sense. The research reveals the memories are sticky, but they're not sticky in the way that we think they are. They're sticky in the sense that they do stick in the memory, and we recall them later with great ease of retrieval and confidence in their details and great depth of feeling about our ability to relive the moment. But they're not actually sticky in the sense of preserving the details of what happened on that day unchanged, at least not as well as it feels like they do. In the words of the authors of this review paper, Hurst and Phelps, quote, "Brown and Kulik and researchers employing the test-retest method are discussing two different claims about forgetting. Brown and Kulik treated forgetting as a failure to have a memory," you know, somebody saying, "I can't remember anything," "whereas those employing a test-retest methodology treat forgetting as a failure to remember the past consistently." When Brown and Kulik stated that there is no forgetting, they are right in the sense that most members of the public report having a memory, even after 10 years. That's not true about a whole lot that goes on in our lives. But then the authors go on, "As the test-retest work indicates, the memory may not be consistent, but it is long-lasting." I think that's a really interesting distinction they're making.
Yeah, yeah. There is something about the memory that is lasting. And which raises the question, why does it last? Why does it remain stuck to the fridge of memory, even if the details of the note or the drawing or whatever have changed, even substantially?
I think that's a great question. So one thing I was fascinated by was details about how the memories change, like what actually changes about them. A few interesting observations they mention. One is that there is a type of consistency that emerges in how we remember these memories, but it's not consistency to the day, to like the original event. The way they put it is, once a consistency emerges in our memory of a flashbulb event, it tends to stick. So I'm just making up this example, but for illustration, let's say you answer a questionnaire on the day of the event saying that you heard about the event because you were up in the morning by yourself making coffee and you heard about it on the radio in the kitchen, and you can give all these details about that. And then you do the same questionnaire a couple of months later, or even a few weeks later, and you say you heard about it when you were stuck in traffic with your carpool group on the freeway on the way to work, and you heard about it on the radio. What the research tends to find is people will tend to pretty consistently reproduce the second story. So you ask them again years on, and they will tell the same story they told in the later questionnaire. So that one tends to stick as if it were the original one, and people think it's the original one. But for some reason, there's this change that occurs early on within the first year after the event. So it's kind of like there is a stickiness quality and a consistency quality, but what sticks is not the memory of the event itself, but the way it emerges as a narrative in your brain. Typically, it sort of they say that it finds this form within the first year after the event. And once it finds that changed form in the brain, of course, to be fair, I want to make sure I'm saying it doesn't always change. It just does in a whole lot of cases. Once it finds that changed form, it tends to change a lot less after that. So it's the inaccurate or inconsistent story that we start telling about how we remember the event that we keep remembering for years on after that.
Fascinating.
Another interesting thing the authors mention here is that the inconsistent details that emerge in later questionnaires about these flashbulb events are not always like just, you know, fabricated details from out of nowhere. One common thing that happens is what they call time slice confusions. And this is essentially the tendency to remember a second or third time you found out about an event as the original time. So maybe you hear about the event on the radio, and then you say in this original questionnaire that later the same day you had a conversation with a friend about the event. A few weeks down the road, you might remember the conversation with the friend as how you found out about the event.
That's interesting. Again, a lot of moving parts there, right? Because the first version in theory here is just like a solo discovery of the event, but the second one is like a social interaction and, you know, conceivably a discussion about the event with social ramifications. And then you're coming back and remembering that, and you know, what does that mean? You know, how much of it is like the power of narrative, like we were talking about? You've given it narrative form. You've given it more life and stickiness. Or is social interaction, is that something that gives it more stickiness, et cetera?
Yeah, it also strikes me as, though that was just a possible example I brought up. I mean, it mm-hmm. strikes me that generally combining multiple finding out about something events into a single event is the same kind of it's the same kind of work like you might do when you're revising a story you've written to like condense things and to like make it punchier, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it even applies, I think, to really unimportant things. I mean, you know, subjectively, you know, things about like, where did you discover a particular artist? You know, where did you first hear a particular song? Like, you know, the less interesting version is like, oh, I heard it a few times and I didn't like it or didn't notice it. And then finally one day I just suddenly it sounded good. No, you want like a more pure discovery story if you want to impress people. It's like, well, I was driving along this deserted stretch of road and this song started playing. And it was like unlike anything I'd ever heard before.
I bet this happens a lot. And this wouldn't be a flashbulb memory, but I bet this same kind of streamlining of memories happens a lot in how people remember meeting like their partner or significant other, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of times people might be kind of in the social orbit of somebody and like meet them a few times and it just doesn't really make any impression. And then they have a moment where they're like, oh, here's the first time we really like talked and got to know each other. And they mm-hmm. remember that as their first meeting when it was not actually, it was just that these other earlier meetings are just not very interesting and nothing happened. So you don't actually remember you met them then.
Yeah. Cause sometimes it happens like that in the movies, but more often than not, it doesn't. More often than not, you have that big dramatic moment, you know, that sappy moment of eyes meeting across the room and the music kicks in. And on some level, yeah, you want to retell your story in a way that fits the myth, that fits the, you know, the ideal version that is presented to you in popular narratives. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right.
It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So coming back to this paper, studies have tried to figure out what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for the formation of flashbulb memories, when and under what conditions are they formed. But the goal of finding these conditions has been, it's proven elusive. Like, it's hard to identify features common to all flashbulb type memories. So the researchers have asked questions like, is the event being consequential to a person's life necessary or sufficient to cause a flashbulb memory? The answer seems to be no. We create flashbulb memories for things that don't personally affect us. Of course, we do also for things that do, but they don't have to affect us personally. Sometimes things that really have no tangible impact on our lives will make one of these type memories. Also, there are lots of things that have major direct impacts on our lives, and they don't elicit flashbulb memories when we find out about them. So it seems to be neither necessary nor sufficient for it to have impact on us personally.
Plus, the impact is subjective, right? Because I can think of plenty of examples where a celebrity has passed and you'll see or know people, or perhaps you are the person who has like a real significant reaction to it. And sometimes it's because it lines up with something else in your personal life, or it's just, you know, you're a huge fan and all that's fair. But it's a different animal than perhaps hearing about this other celebrity that died the same week that you don't have the connection with, or they don't remind you of your dad or your mom or your grandfather or something.
Right. And unsurprisingly, there's at least some research finding that people are more likely to report high confidence in the accuracy of their flashbulb memories if the central figure in the public event is someone they feel a social bond with. And that comes around to another factor influencing the formation of these memories that the researchers bring up, and that's the concept of social identity. It seems like flashbulb memories, even though they relate to finding out about public rather than personal events, are more likely to be things that somehow kind of form the story of yourself. So to read a passage from Hurst and Phelps here, quote, "They play this role in part because they mark those instances during which people feel that they are part of the history of their social group." As Neisser in 1982 wrote, and here they're quoting this other researcher, one, quote, "recalls an occasion where two narratives that we ordinarily keep separate, the course of history and the course of our lives, were momentarily put into alignment. Details are linked between our own history and history, capital H." Flashbulb memories are the places we line up our lives with the source of history itself and say, "I was there." I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
about the intersection of the two lines. So yeah, we tell the story of ourselves, but sometimes there's just like the moment that connects with the event that everybody else remembers, with something that was known and experienced by everyone. Almost kind of like the Forrest Gump syndrome, you know, you're intersecting with known public events in history. And for some reason, we form these feelings that we're remembering these events very strongly, and they stick with us throughout our lives.
Fascinating.
And the authors point out interesting findings that the common feelings of a social group about a historical event may affect and alter how members of that group remember the autobiographical details of learning of that event themselves. For example, the authors cite one study that this is the kind of finding that it's like almost too perfect, so I wouldn't want to hang too much on this study unless similar findings were replicated all over the place. But in isolation, it is interesting. So the researchers were Berntsen and Thompson in 2005, and they studied elderly Danes who had something like flashbulb memories of when they learned about the German invasion of Denmark, the Nazi invasion of their country in World War II. And when they learned about the German withdrawal from their country. In these autobiographical memories related to these public events, the Danes were more likely to remember the weather as being worse than it was on the day they found out about the invasion, and to remember the weather as being better than it actually was on the day of the withdrawal. So, like, these autobiographical memories are being influenced by, like, you know, sort of like feelings as part of a social group about the moral valence or the positive or negative valence of what's happening in the news. Finally, another feature of these sticky memories can be illustrated in the title of a paper from 2003 by Jennifer M. Tallarico and David C. Rubin. And that title is Confidence, Not Consistency, Characterizes Flashbulb Memories. This was in Psychological Science. Again, that's the year 2003. Hurst and Phelps write, quote, "One agreed-upon difference between flashbulb memories and everyday autobiographical memories, even those that are rated as important, is that confidence in flashbulb memories remains high, even when consistency declines, whereas confidence in everyday autobiographical memories declines along with consistency." So does that make sense? Like the memories for regular events, they decline in consistency, you know, trying to remember what you had for lunch or what you talked about at work or whatever. That declines in consistency of recall over time. We remember them differently. But also for those regular events, we lose confidence in how accurate those memories are. So ironically, for normal memories, we're sort of accurately assessing that our fading memories might be wrong, whereas with these incredibly sticky flashbulb memories, we lose consistency of recall over time. They do degrade in quality, and you can show that it changes how we remember them. But we're much more likely to say in these cases with very high confidence, no, 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 it's not changing. I remember exactly how it happened.
Well, yeah, the way that I recall it being discussed before in the past when I read about it was that, yeah, these additional details, things like what was I eating for breakfast or what did I wear that day, or even, you know, some of the other things surrounding the discovery or the hearing of the word, the brain kind of fills in the blanks on that. There's something more important that has to be solidified in your memory, and therefore it kind of like the memory, the rest of the memory is rushed. They're like, well, it's like there's an assembly crew in there. It's like, well, what should we put down for breakfast on this memory? It doesn't matter. Just put down anything. We can change it later. We will change it later. The important thing is that this terrible thing happened or this great thing happened and they heard about it. And
I was there.
Yeah. And that you were that they were there and that they are part of it. I like this idea that it's like, yeah, it's like capital H history and lowercase h history converging. Like, in a way, it's defining self in comparison to the larger group. You know, perhaps you can also throw in the, you know, vital survival information as well. Something terrible happened and it has to be remembered because I want/need to avoid terrible things. But yeah, the details are not as important. It's that central detail that has to be recorded.
Right. That moment of finding out feels entirely like you can recreate it in your mind right now. But there's a good chance that if you had written down what happened that day and you compared it to what you remember now, it would be different. Mm. And so a question would be, why are we so confident about the accuracy of our flashbulb memories when research shows that, you know, you can show that they're not as accurate as we think they are? And this is hard to say. The authors point out, you know, there's a general finding about memory that, quote, vividness, elaborateness, and ease of retrieval are thought to influence the judgment that an event occurred. So if you can make the details of a memory really vivid, you know, you can just see them in your mind, and if you can add lots of details, and if you can make the memory come to mind without much effort, people have more confidence that the memory is accurate, even if it's not. And this would apply to other types of memories too. And there just may be features of flashbulb memories that incubate these qualities of vividness, elaborateness, and ease of retrieval. Maybe because they come up often in conversation, or maybe because of this, maybe it has something to do about this, yeah, this intersection or connection point with history more broadly that causes us to almost kind of like write them out as a detailed story in the mind in a way that you don't do for most other events, even important events.
Yeah, and then you end up having high confidence in this narrative that is ultimately, you know, can be, you know, defining of yourself. And so, of course, you're going to have confidence in it. Because what happens when you don't have confidence in the autobiographical stories that define who you are? I mean, you end up like, I guess, you know, at least like me, because I feel like every time we cover these memory topics, I kind of, it forces a lot of self-reflection on the memories that do define me, you know, and I think back on them as like, well, you know, to what extent is that what happened? And then to what extent does it matter if it's not? Like, you have to sort of face the fact that, you know, all memories are potentially incorrect to some degree.
Right. And, you know, I want to come back on the other hand and say that all these studies about the faultiness of memory, they don't mean that like none of your memories are accurate. You know, probably a lot of your memories are basically accurate. The point is that they're not as reliable as they feel.
Yeah, like there's a lot of truth in your memories.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just like, there's a decent chance that you remember a lot of things with high confidence. And in fact, it didn't happen that way.
Yeah.
But plenty of things did happen more or less the way you remember them.
Yeah. I mean, and it cuts both ways, right? I mean, you can certainly have a memory that is more traumatic because it has been made more traumatic through recall and through, you know, the way that it is ultimately embellished through memory. But other times, like, you remember something with kind of rose-tinted glasses, you know? You remember the fun part of a particular vacation as opposed to the, you know, the minor squabbles that may have accompanied the endeavor.
Right. Oh, and so one thing this brings up is that with flashbulb memories, because they often involve these public events that are negative in quality, that could lead people to the erroneous assumption that flashbulb memories work the same way like traumatic memories of mm-hmm. firsthand events work. And that's not necessarily true. We don't know the extent to which there are similarities and differences there fully. Firsthand traumatic memories, I think, are going to be governed by possibly some different things than these flashbulb memories are. But that also brings us to this question that you brought up earlier that I think is a good one. A few studies have looked at flashbulb memories elicited by positive public events. You know, follow the Berlin Wall. A lot of people who remember that see that as a positive thing, or, you know, maybe World Cup victories for your home country or something. But most of these studies look at negative events, and that probably just has a lot to do with like the nature of big public events in the news. You know, there's more often a big negative event than a big positive event, at least in how it's covered in the media. Mm-hmm. So if we had more investigations of big public positive events, do you think there would be any major differences in memory responses, or would it be pretty much the same thing?
Yeah, I guess one of the problems is just like the negative, the catastrophic headlines are the ones that like instantly come to mind. Like when you try to, I have trouble just thinking of significant good news events that would have that kind of magnitude. They would have to be, you know, things like the end of major wars, the, you know, just overwhelmingly good news. And it seems like
moon landing, maybe
moon landing. Moon landing is a good one. Yeah.
This might just be a fact of reality that good news is stuff that tends to develop gradually over time. And then you can sort of discover it retrospectively. You can be like, oh, something very good happened over the last 25 years gradually. Mm-hmm. Whereas bad news often tends to happen all at once.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. It's like the way we retrospectively evaluate the importance of a moment is key. And is there like this one moment that really like rings out as opposed to like a gradual swelling?
Right. Like if you're trying to remember a public person, if it's a person you have positive feelings about, the good things they did are probably like a whole career of good things that mm-hmm. developed gradually and you could develop an appreciation for it. It didn't happen one day, but they die on one day.
Right. It punctuates this lifetime of achievements or contributions, et cetera. Forces you to reflect on those and value those, often, you know, value those even more while also feeling, you know, this at very least intense bittersweetness regarding the whole situation where you realize, oh, I loved all these albums that, say, David Bowie put out. I liked the last album, but I didn't know it was going to be the last album, and now I do. A lot of emotions to feel about those moments.
So there we go. Flashbulb memories. Actually very sticky, but not in the way people think they are. Illusory stickiness, maybe. So I thought that was very interesting. And maybe we can come back to other types of sticky memories and sticky memory research in the future.
Absolutely. I think we'll always come back to memory-based topics.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. All right, well, for the last little bit here, I want to bring it back to physical stickiness. I thought it might be interesting to think about sticky substances, specifically glues and adhesives in history. The most crucial sticky substance to consider in all of this is plant resin. Plant resin is exuded by some trees and other plants, such as fir and pine trees in particular. And most resin trickles out in response to injury of some sort to the tree or plant in question. These resins are not soluble in water, and they typically lose volatile compounds via evaporation, leaving behind a soft residue that is initially soluble but becomes insoluble as it ages. Okay, initially, however, it's viscous, it's sticky, and if you don't already have like the smell memory in your nostrils, well, then if you're of a certain age, then perhaps you remember a key scene in 1989's Christmas Vacation starring Chevy Chase. There's a scene where he has just cut down a Christmas tree, and it's the evening. He's laying in bed next to his wife, played by Beverly D'Angelo, and Chevy Chase is like messing around with a magazine. He's trying to, and then he's trying to turn off the light, and his fingers are sticking to everything because they're covered with tree resin.
This is a great scene because it's not the point of the scene. He's just happening in the background that every time he touches a magazine page, it tears off on his fingers.
Yeah.
I myself have vivid memories, which may or may not be accurate to reality, of being a kid and climbing on pine trees in, I guess, around the playground at my school and getting sap or resin, whatever it is from the tree, stuck to my hands and to my arms. Actually, I remember it going up my wrists and stuff. And again, may or may not be accurate, but what I remember is that it was really, really difficult to wash off. Like you'd rub it with water and soap and it would just stay on there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just very sticky stuff where, yeah, if you're horsing around in the woods at all, you're going to encounter it at some point. And you may wonder like, will this ever come off? And you know, eventually it does. Anyway, yeah. And as far as Christmas Vacation goes, a lot of broad comedy in that movie. But that's kind of like one of the nice scenes of more subtle comedy that I always liked. Though I guess it gets a little broad towards the end of that sequence when they're knocking over the lamp and so forth, and his hand gets stuck to her hair.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. I just remember am I remembering this right? Like he touches the magazine pages and they just tear off on his fingers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, speaking of movies from the 80s and 90s, if you've ever seen a little film titled Jurassic Park from 1993, then you know the basics of what I'm going to talk about next. Insects and other organic bits winding up stuck in the tree resin and eventually becoming amber. A whole host of insects were trapped in this way and later discovered by humans, includes flies, lice, beetles, ants, butterflies, and moths. Amber has also been found to contain spiders, webbing, frogs, crustaceans, hair, feathers, all sorts of stuff.
It's nature's museum display case.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, going back to what happens, you imagine a scenario where a tree is injured one way or another, by another organism, by, you know, something falling into it, et cetera. And things live on the trees. Things come into contact with the trees, and then they get caught in it. They may overflow them and then ultimately preserve them. Now, it is of note on the whole Jurassic Park idea, the idea of DNA extraction from a mosquito in amber, as seen in Jurassic Park. This seems to remain unrealized. Despite some starts and stops in actual scientific attempts to do just this, contamination by modern DNA seems to have played a role in some of the false positives that have popped up. Examples, you know, where scientists have come forward with a study and said, we've done it. We've been able to successfully retrieve DNA in one form or another from the contents of this amber. And I believe in those cases, it tends to be a situation where you actually have modern DNA that has contaminated the results.
I sort of hesitate to say this because I didn't double check before we recorded, but I think there would be a real problem trying to extract DNA from like dinosaur era insects in amber, like they do in Jurassic Park, just because the DNA molecule degrades too much over time for it to last that long. But maybe you could feasibly get DNA from an insect in amber from more recent times.
Yeah, apparently there's still some scientific debate about how long DNA can survive in different settings. I guess it's a never-say-never situation. Some scientists continue to pursue this angle for potential ancient DNA retrieval. And, of course, ancient covers a lot of ground. In 2020, scientists actually succeeded in pulling insect DNA from amber, though the amber in question was from 2014, common era 2014, to be clear.
Okay.
So it's not a home run, not a touchdown or what have you, but, it's something to go on. Now, as a tangent, I was looking around about ancient DNA retrieval, and I got kind of interested in a few different angles on this. And a 2022 paper, the title caught my attention. It was from the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution, titled "Ancient Human Genomes and Environmental DNA, and the Cement Attaching 2,000-Year-Old Head Lice Nets." And this paper indeed explored to what extent, quote, host DNA is protected by the cement that glues head lice nits to the hair of ancient Argentinian mummies 1,500 to 2,000 years old.
Wow. This is my kind of study. What did they find?
Well, the findings suggest that ectoparasitic lice sheaths may prove to be a reasonable tool in ancient DNA retrieval. So stickiness strikes again here. Like there's this idea that, as we're trying to, again, ongoing debate about to what extent DNA survives and where it can survive in what conditions. This study indicates that, yeah, the place to look might be these nits, these little places where lice have used their glue to hold eggs in place.
Beautiful.
Though, of course, one can't help but go in a sci-fi direction with all of this and imagine half lice, half human mummy hybrids shambling out of the cloning tanks, where it's like, we did it. We cloned the mummies. Oh, we forgot about all that lice DNA.
I am Brundle Lice.
Yeah. At any rate, amber has managed to preserve insect activity. We have examples of mating, examples of egg laying, parasitism, swarming behavior. Just a few examples of the things where we can look and say, okay, not only do we see a particular species, not only do we see this snapshot in time of what the organism looked like, sometimes we can make out behavior. We can also sometimes make out key details about individual structures. I believe some of this has come up on the show before. What did this particular type of insect's head look like? What did its particular, feeding apparatus look like millions of years ago? Structural color is another thing that is sometimes preserved and can be analyzed. And, we're talking about specimens from as long ago as like 230 million years.
Okay, so whether or not amber can successfully preserve the DNA molecule intact enough over time, it can certainly preserve macroscopic objects, structures, and almost like scenes or dioramas in some case.
Yeah. So something that is physically sticky ends up preserving, creating a kind of like sticky physical memory for humans to contemplate in the far future.
Interesting.
Now, speaking of prehistoric stickiness, speaking of the ancients and sap, I thought we might turn to the oldest manufactured glue that we know of in human history, and that's birch bark tar. This is created by heating birch bark via, I think there are four different methods that are generally recognized. I was reading about this in a 2019 paper by Nikas et al., published in the journal Anthropology. According to these authors, there's condensation method, there's ash mound method, there's pit and vessel method, and there's raised structure method, which involves an earthen mound containing a vessel and screen. Those are in order of complexity as well. And the more complex, the greater the yield. So my understanding based on this is like, yeah, if you're using the condensation method, you would have to do so much more of it to get the same amount of birch bark tar that you would get using the raised structure method. So birch bark tar use dates back to the Paleolithic period. Our ancestors used it to haft tools, to decorate objects. But this wasn't only a technology of Homo sapiens. I found this really fascinating. Archaeological evidence shows that Neanderthals, our extinct evolutionary cousins, also used it and seem to have produced it, using it on at least some of their tools. I don't think all of them, but we have found Neanderthal artifacts where they used this tar to construct their tools. And they use some of the more complex methods of deriving the birch bark tar.
Ah, so like higher up the list of four?
Yeah, yeah. So they weren't just using the most primitive version of it, which I think is also pretty, potentially insightful about who the Neanderthals were and what they were up to. And I think in general, whether you're talking about prehistoric humans or Neanderthals, it's easy for a lot of us, certainly without deeper knowledge of actual tool construction, and methods of tool construction specifically in prehistoric times, to assume that, everything was lashed together, right? Everything kind of looked like there's kind of an image of a Stone Age tool that may enter your mind, and it involves like a, something kind of wedged in wood, maybe strapped with some hide in wood. And you don't think about how important adhesive technology was and has never stopped being.
We talked about this in our invention episode on chewing gum, I believe, but the Iceman Ötzi, the fourth millennium BCE Stone Age mummy who was preserved in a glacier in the Italian Alps, was discovered in the early 1990s. Ötzi, so many fascinating things about Ötzi, but one of which was he carried with him this copper axe. And the copper axe, the blade of the axe was secured to the handle with multiple means. It did have some wrapping of leather straps, like you were talking about, but it also was glued in place using birch bark tar, adhesives made from the birch tree. Also in that episode, we talked about a paper called Chewing Tar in the Early Holocene that was about indications that lumps of birch bark tar had been chewed. And the idea is like, okay, was this being used as like chewing gum in the ancient world? Or maybe was chewing on it a way of treating it so that it could be used in the creation of tools?
Yeah, I remember this discussion now. It's fascinating. Again, it's so easy to dismiss the importance of adhesives, the importance of glues and sticky things, But I mean, it makes sense too, because again, humans would have gone out into the world. They got sticky. They got sticky things on them, and everything that they encountered, they inevitably asked the question: can I use this? Is this of use to me? How can I combine this with other things to create useful things? And of course, sticky is going to play an important role there. And it, factors into construction, obviously. We already talked we talked about mud bricks in previous episodes. We talked about sticky rice mortar earlier in this series. But there are also plenty of other methods of construction out there. Like one that I was reading about is Waddle and Daub, which, sounds like an interesting law firm or something. But no, this is where you have woven flexible branches called wattle, and they're essentially daubed up with a sticky combination of such materials as mud and clay and possibly dung. Not all that different, I guess, in some respects than, compared to mud bricks. But again, another construction method, another recipe for building something that involves using something that is sticky. And of course, if you get back into the problem of the word sticky and just how vague it is, I mean, basically that can bring in any kind of like plaster scenario, mortar scenario, brick making scenario, and more. Now, I have to say, I really wanted to end it on a monster here. I was like, there's got to be a nice sticky monster out there. And perhaps there is one, and I just didn't have time to find it. I got really excited when I discovered a Japanese yokai known as Beto Beto-san, which is sometimes translated as Mr. Sticky. Though this ultimately doesn't really hold up, because apparently the more accurate translation is Mr. Footsteps. This is the connection I think only makes sense within the Japanese language. But basically, this is a yokai that follows people around at night on dark streets, and you hear his footfalls. So it's like the whole idea is just the sound of being followed in the dark, or the potential of being followed in the dark. It doesn't actually have anything to do with like a super sticky ghost creature, much to my dismay.
Bummer. I wish it was a monster with like sticky hands, like the sticky hand toy.
Yeah, Yeah. So I don't know if anyone out there can think of any sticky monsters, especially as we get into our Halloween festivities here. Let us know. I guess you could talk about the xenomorph to some extent. It did like sticking people to walls and in walls.
Yeah, it secreted you never really see it secreting that stuff, do you? You see the caustic blood. I wonder, do you think it's only the queen that secretes all of that sticky material that cocoons the people?
I don't know if it has. So I know this varies. There's no like hard canon on this, but I guess you have like the warrior xenomorphs. You have the queen xenomorph. Do you have like some sort of like construction drone type xenomorph, or would that be done by the warriors? Like, who's building that elaborate nest? Like, she's busy creating eggs, right? If we're going to compare it to, you know, like say ant and termite models, you know, her role is very specific within the hive, and you must have some other classification of the species that's busy building these things and secreting stuff and sticking people in walls after, you know, after an egg has been positioned in the proximity.
That's right. Ripley famously asks an alien, so who's laying the eggs? But I have a secondary question. So who's secreting the gunk?
Yeah. There we go. That's what we need for the next alien film. Let's really dive down into who's secreting here.
It must be something we haven't seen yet.
Ooh. A whole movie about the most boring member of the, but scientifically interesting member of the xenomorph hive.
I'm in.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close it up there. But hey, we'd love to hear from everyone out there. What are your thoughts on stickiness? Can you think of a sticky monster in general? Oh, and sticky memories. Well, you know, this is something we can all relate to. So I'm hoping we'll hear from a lot of folks on that. Also, like I just said, we're getting into the Halloween season here, and we're going to quickly be, you know, putting together a loose outline of what we're going to be covering. But now's a great time if you have something particular in mind, or if you want to remind us of something we said we'd cover in the past but didn't, then write in. We'd love to hear from you. A reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Monday, short form artifact or monster fact on Wednesday, and on Friday we set aside Most Serious Concerns to just talk about a weird movie on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.